From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Tom Morris has written more than 20 books, most of which distill ancient wisdom from the Greek and Roman philosophers into practical ideas for living in the modern world. Some of the titles you might recognize: If Aristotle Ran General Motors, Philosophy for Dummies, The Stoic Art of Living, Inner Resilience and Outer Results, The Art of Achievement, If Harry Potter Ran General Electric, and most recently, he published his first novel, The Oasis Within, A Journey of Preparation. Before he moved to Wilmington, in the 1990s, he taught philosophy at Notre Dame. Today, he travels the country giving speeches and conducting seminars on how to internalize the principles, the human virtues, that translate into profitable, character-driven companies and structures within which people can live well. And he is not sitting on top of a mountain today. He happens to be with us, and he will answer your questions about how to create a meaningful life and what it even means to live well. Tom Morris, so many questions there. Welcome to Coastline. Let's get started.
Thanks a lot. Great to be with you, Rachel.
If you have questions for Tom Morris about how to interpret the great thinkers from the ages, Aristotle, Confucius, Socrates, Plato, or you just like to hear a wise man talk about the meaning of life, give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Tom Morris, you call yourself a public philosopher. What does that mean, and how is that different from the kind of philosopher you were before you became a public philosopher?
That's a good question, Rachel. I was the first person in my family ever to go to college. My mother told me there was no money for college at all, so I should figure out after high school, you know, what kind of job I wanted. But then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I got a Morehead Cain scholarship to go to Chapel Hill. And being a Morehead at Chapel Hill got me a full ride at Yale to do two PhDs there. I specialized in philosophy of religion, and I was hired by Notre Dame because they wanted to become the best place in the world in philosophy of religion. So I ended up spending about 15 years writing academic books and articles that about 34 people in the world could understand. They were so esoteric. They were so dense. They were so convoluted. Lots of logic, lots of metaphysics and epistemology. But then all of a sudden, I started getting calls from business groups in South Bend, Indiana. Hey, we hear how popular your classes are. Could you come into the Chamber of Commerce and give a talk, or to my bank or to my real estate company? So all of a sudden, I end up doing philosophy, not just in a classroom, but in public. And in no time at all, I was doing philosophy all over the world. So that's kind of what it is to be a public philosopher.
And the idea here is that these virtues, these principles that you're teaching, are not just theoretical ideas that sound nice and make you feel good on the weekend. These are things that actually drive the quality of one's life.
That's right. I mean, there's a whole forgotten side of philosophy. Up until about 1900, every well-educated person had read, for example, the Stoic philosophers, Epictetus, Seneca, Emperor Marcus Aurelius. They had amazing wisdom about how to live life every day. The founders of this country were really well-read in ancient practical philosophy. But for the last 100 years, 150 years, in an attempt to kind of mimic the natural sciences, philosophy got more and more theoretical, losing its practical side. So my wonderful joy and job has been to kind of rediscover the ancient practical side of philosophy. These virtues, or strengths, as the word virtue meant in Latin, these strengths that we can bring to every challenge we face and that can enhance our lives in everything we do.
So what is it all for then? What is the meaning of life?
Oh,
I'm hearing Monty Python music in the background. But in your book, you actually tackle this.
Yeah, yeah.
You actually get to the meaning of life. If Aristotle Ran General Motors, it's on page 95, and several pages before that, you talk about the fact that you're going to explain it, and I keep thinking this is like the Monty Python movie where you get to the French countryside and it points to a house. But no, what is the meaning of life?
Well, we're not going to mess around today. We're going to get right to it. I should just tell everybody, really, if you want the answer, go get a copy of If Aristotle Ran General Motors and go to page 95. No, I will give you a hint. If you go to a philosophy classroom almost everywhere in America, any university or college, and you see that the meaning of life is going to be talked about in a class, typically the professor will march you through 20 answers given to the question, or 20 claims that the question makes no sense, and the professor won't take a stance one way or the other. Well, I decided I wanted to take a stance on this, so I surveyed all the practical wisdom literature of the ages, and I realized that from the wisest people, the meaning of life comes down to, I have to pause here, right? Creative love or loving creativity. We're here, we are created to be creators in a loving way. We're here to embody love. We're here to bring love to the world by creating structures and businesses and families and neighborhoods and enterprises that can help other people flourish. I kind of elaborate on this in the book, but I've had so many people say to me, wow, that stretch in your book, If Aristotle Ran General Motors, helped me really deeply understand my life for the first time ever.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with author and philosopher Tom Morris. He's a former philosophy professor at Notre Dame. He's written more than 20 books, including If Aristotle Ran General Motors. If you have a question for Tom Morris, you can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Tom Morris, do you think most people live their lives from that point of view, holding loving creativity at the center and seeing that as worthwhile and having the most meaning, or do most of us miss it?
You know, I think there's a mixed answer to that question. I think more people than you might imagine do live their lives out of a desire to show love and to contribute something, to be creative. Otherwise, the world would just come apart, right? We'd live in an entire globe of anarchy. Now, there are parts of the world in anarchy right now. But in the civilized countries that have a relatively stable society, people who live like that are kind of holding things together. And those who don't live like that feel unsatisfied. They feel unhappy. And they're often on a quest which will eventually lead them to find that sort of answer. It was my job as a philosopher just to spell it out and make it clear.
Can you give us a sort of real-world example of someone who embodies that idea, loving creativity?
Yeah. I had a chance to meet the founder of Whole Foods a few years ago. I got an email out of the blue. Hey, I've read all your books. They've changed my life. If you're ever in Austin, Texas, I'm going to take you out to dinner. And I thought, great. I'm always up for a free meal, you know. So I write this guy back without even paying attention to who it was. And I said, yeah, I'll be in Austin March 23rd and 24th. And he said, I'm out of town those days. Could you come a day early? And you can spend the night at my house, and I'll fix dinner for you. And I'm thinking, who is this guy? And I look down at his signature. It's the founder of CEO and founder of Whole Foods, John Mackey. And I thought, I'm gonna go visit this guy in his house just to see what's in his refrigerator. You know, the Whole Foods guy. And so I get to talking to him about why he founded Whole Foods, and it was obviously all about providing love in people's lives, doing something creative for people. His little store in Austin, Texas, there was a flood, and he didn't have insurance, and everything was ruined. And he thought, well, that's the end of his dream. The next day, he came to just look at all the damage, and already his customers were working to clean out the store and to fix it up. Because he had given love to the community, they were giving it back to him, and that kind of boosted his confidence to a whole new level. So Whole Foods, rather than being one tiny little store in Austin, Texas, is all over the world because this guy has creative love at the core of his motivations.
And so that is, you're saying, not only one of the drivers behind the business success, but it's also personal fulfillment for this person. So he's a CEO. What do you say to someone who maybe is working in a fast food restaurant drive-thru?
Yeah.
Is that – because in one of your other books, the fiction, the novel that you just published, The Oasis Within, and we'll get to that in a later segment, but you do talk about how greatness is within everyone, and everyone is destined to ascend to their own throne, so to speak.
Yeah.
So what do you say to that person who has not ascended?
Yeah, you know, everybody who has any sort of job at all, and even people who are jobless, we all have a sphere of influence. We all are around other people. And what do we bring to those people every day? Do we bring kindness, a good word, something that's uplifting, or do we bring hostility and irritation and anger? Are we improving our circumstances, or are we somehow participating in corrupting our circumstance, making them worse? Everybody, regardless of, you know, whether they're a CEO or whether they're a frontline worker, whether it's stay-at-home mom or dad, we have this ability to be creative and be loving in little ways every day. And sometimes those are the most important ways.
You're listening to Coastline, and we have Anne from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. Mr. Morris?
Yes.
I have read your book, The Stoic Art of Living. I'm on my sixth time through it.
Wow.
And I take, and I take notes because Seneca and Epictetus and that other person.
Marcus Aurelius, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And you together have sort of laid out a plan for a living that I aspire to.
Wow.
And so I figured I'd like to learn it, not just read it once or twice. I'd like to learn it and internalize it and try to live it.
Mm.
But it doesn't fit in today's culture.
Yeah.
For me, everybody is so black and white.
Yeah.
And there's no... nobody's seeking for integrity or wisdom and so forth. And it says, Seneca says, wisdom is the perfect good of the human mind.
Yeah.
Philosophy is the love of wisdom and the endeavor to attain it. Well, I subscribe to all those thoughts.
That's great.
And I don't know people to talk to about it.
A great question. We're about to go to break. How can we see more of this in our own culture? You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking with Tom Morris, author of more than 20 books, including The Stoic Art of Living. We're taking your questions. Give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back, we'll have Tom Morris answer Anne's question. Thanks so much for your call, Anne. This is Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking with Tom Morris about how to take the wisdom from the ancient philosophical traditions and turn it into a practical guide for living. The phone lines are open. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. We just heard from Anne from Wilmington, who is asking about some of the ideas in The Stoic Art of Living and how she can continue to practice those principles, ethical principles, in a culture that doesn't really seem to support that.
Yeah, that's a very good question. The fact that she started out saying she's read the book six times, very impressive. I mean, C.S. Lewis once said, if a book is not worth reading twice, it wasn't worth reading once. And, you know, I try to write every one of my books so that it will stand up to repeated readings and people get deeper and deeper into the ideas and the implementation of the ideas. And that's what Anne was calling about. Really, when you try to live a life of wisdom, sometimes you feel like you're going it alone. It's like it's a pioneering endeavor, like people don't even get what you're talking about. Because the word wisdom, most people think they sort of know what it means, but they kind of don't. If you ask people, what is wisdom? They'd say, I don't know, a kind of knowledge. Well, wisdom is insight for living. The word philosophy, philo, love of, sophia, wisdom, is an interesting thing. An object of love, when you have it, you embrace it. When you lack it, you pursue it. Philosophy is just meant to be the pursuit and embracing of wisdom or insight for living. And the thing that Anne's experiencing initially, when you get really excited about philosophy or excited about the pursuit of wisdom, you may be the only person on your block or in your office that is excited about that particular thing. Unlike if you become a Carolina basketball fan, you got a crowd of people around you. But eventually, wisdom attracts wisdom. The more you try to embody this in your life, the more you talk about it with other people. And sometimes that's tough to broach a topic people don't normally talk about. Socrates said, the least important things we think about and talk about the most important things we think about and talk about the least.
And so what do you do every morning and every evening to implement these ideas and make sure that you stay aligned with them? How do you do it?
You know, I give myself some quiet time in the morning, and I was never a big meditator. I could sit down in a classic meditation position, and in about 4 minutes, it would seem like I'd been there a week and a half. You know, it was just not easy for me. Until February of 2011, one day at breakfast, it was like a movie started playing in my head, the most vivid daydream of my life. And I ran upstairs, and I started typing this daydream, and it turned into the book, The Oasis Within. I learned in writing that book that if I wanted the movie to play, I had to learn to get beyond the chatter of the conscious mind, to get beyond the clutter, and go deep where the real treasure is to be found in our unconscious minds. I was a guitar player for many years before I became an academic, and I envisioned the volume control on the amplifier and turning the volume down to zero of that conscious mind so that the deeper ideas can percolate up. Every morning I try to give myself at least a few minutes of this. And sometimes remarkable things will come about my life, about self-knowledge, about something I should be doing, about the way I should be doing something. And if I didn't give myself that little quiet time every morning, and now it used to be it could take a long time to get into that mental state. Now I can do it in a matter of seconds. And it's a very refreshing thing to do. It leads you to be able to be led by the philosopher's most important piece of advice, which was know yourself.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Tom Morris, philosopher, modern public philosopher, and author of more than 20 books. And we have Ariane from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank WHQR for getting Mr. Morris in today. WHQR does amazing things for our community. And this particular interview with Mr. Morris is exemplary of the service that WHQR offers.
Thank you, man.
The question I have is, how can those of us that that try to live and live out the oasis within, how can we spread the good word and share this goodwill philosophy with others? What would you think would be the best way to make that happen?
Wow, that's a good question, right? It's funny because I used to tell my students at Notre Dame, you guys can get away with raising topics with your friends in a special way because you've had me as your professor. You don't have to say, hey, I was thinking about inner wisdom and inner resilience this morning and have everybody look at you like you're crazy. You know, you could say, hey, I've got this philosophy professor who was talking about our inner resources for any challenge. And they're going to say, oh, really? You know, and that'll start a conversation. The very fact, if you read The Oasis Within and then tell people, hey, I was reading this book the other day, this novel that was really different and it had some ideas in it that I'm trying out in my own life. And what do you think about this? You know, it almost gives you an excuse to bring up these topics that ironically we almost never talk about, right? And so that's a great question because I don't want to just write books that people enjoy all by themselves and never get a chance to talk about. The things that really – I get emails almost every day. One guy, an eye doctor in Pennsylvania, has bought 20 copies of The Oasis Within and 20 copies of the subsequent book, The Golden Palace, to give to his friends just so they can talk about them together. I mean, that makes me feel great because I know – the wisdom doesn't end with what's on the page. In fact, what's on the page, I'm hoping, will start people talking about things that matter in their lives. And I know you're going to have insights that I would love you to write me about because that's the reason I publish, not because I have all the answers. But if I can start generating all the right conversations, I'm going to benefit too.
Thanks so much for your call, Ariane. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with author and philosopher Tom Morris. He's a former philosophy professor at Notre Dame, written more than 20 books, including The Oasis Within and If Aristotle Ran General Motors. You can ask a question or make a comment by calling us today at 910-343-1138. You can also reach us by email today at coastline@whqr.org. And we talked a little earlier, Tom Morris, about
the culture today. When you wrote If Aristotle Ran General Motors, that was in the 90s,
yeah.
And you were talking about how important it was for businesses to start taking a look at whether they were embodying some of these important character-driven principles, whether they were doing business by the guiding light of certain virtues that have been talked about from these ancient wisdom traditions. Have we made any progress or have we devolved in the last, say, 20 years?
Yeah, you do wonder that, don't you? I mean, every era has its scandals, right? We had in the 90s, we had Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing, and we had all these ethical blow-ups, right, where big businesses collapsed under the weight of unethical conduct. And all of a sudden, everybody was asking me to speak on ethics because they didn't want that to happen in their company. And when I would go into businesses, I would learn pretty quickly, most people thought of ethics as a way of staying out of trouble. So the main message I could bring in was this. No, the Greeks and the Romans had a deeper view. Ethics is about creating strength in a unique way. In fact, the word virtue comes from the Latin virtu, which meant prowess or strength. What strengths do we bring to any situation? To be connected to reality, to be honest about what we see in reality, to be kind to other people, to know how to work with other people. These are not the icing on the cake of business success. These are the most important ingredients in the cake. And so once I got out there as a philosopher, I was seeing people really, you know, lap this up. They were ready to hear the deepest truths about ethics. Now, I have seen pockets of excellence based on ethical principles develop all over this country, but the culture at large still needs to get the message, right? I mean, we're not in a time where everybody's got on the ethical toga of Aristotle.
And when you look at our current presidential campaign, the dialogue there is ridden with vitriol.
Yeah.
It's also full of hyperbole.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about one particular side. I'm
talking
about both sides.
That's right.
And I think what's most notable in the context of this discussion is that both candidates have public ethical problems.
Yeah,
The American public doesn't trust them for different reasons. What does that say about where we are now? How have we arrived at this place where we have two people who are competing to become the leader of the free world, and neither of them are considered completely trustworthy or ethical by the people who need to choose them?
And what's even scarier is that we're not the only country having that problem right now, right? In pockets all over the world, people are having the exact same problems. And it's a funny thing. I was in New York City giving a talk to chief information and chief technology officers from 25 of the biggest companies in America. And we were sitting in a beautiful room having breakfast overlooking the Statue of Liberty. And just apropos of nothing, I sort of made a remark over breakfast that Aristotle thought that politics was about how to best live well together. And then I said, so political discourse, political conversation ought to be the most ennobling form of discourse. And as soon as I said that, everybody at the table laughed so loud. I thought that one guy next to me who had 400,000 employees, I thought he was going to choke. He turned so red laughing. And the question was,
can you say that again? Political discourse is supposed to be what?
The most ennobling form of discourse, because it's about how best to live well together. And hasn't it become the absolute opposite, right? Have we been creating the conditions in America that would invite the most ethical people, the people with the highest characters, to want to run for public office? Or have we created obstacle after obstacle with the way we approach campaigning, with the way we approach negative advertising, so that people who are good people, they just don't want to get down in the mud and have anything to do with this for the most part? In fact, the Moorhead scholars, the Moorhead Cain scholars throughout the years, we all get together once every 3 years. And in one of our recent Moorhead forums, a guy who's very active in national politics was trying to encourage all past Moorhead scholars to at least consider the possibility of running for office, because we need people with sharp minds and good hearts to think about getting into leadership positions.
Are we setting the stage for your campaign right now, Tom Morris?
I hope not. I think my strength is being a thinker. But you know what? If I can encourage the right kind of people to get involved at every level of political life, you know, the local level, the state level, because then it percolates up to the national level. I've always had this, what I call the inner circle principle. I think that we're supposed to create strong relationships and families to contribute to strong neighborhoods, to strong cities and states and nations and a stronger world. So the more we do things right on a local level, the better we're going to be at every other level.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with author and philosopher Tom Morris. We have an email. Rosa writes, "Hi, I'm currently a graduate student with UNCW. How do I practice wisdom? Are there simple laws to follow? Also, how do I shift my ideas or my mind in order to see changes in my life to help me reach my potential or personal life goals?" What would you say,
Rosa?
Yeah,
this is great. I mean, a lot can be said. Wisdom is all about perspective, not mistaking appearances for realities. You know, looking beyond and beneath surface appearances, asking yourself, yeah, what's really going on here? I know this is how it seems, but what's really going on? There's an image in The Oasis Within. That's a story about an old man and a young boy, uncle and nephew, crossing the desert in Egypt in 1934. And at one point, the old man is talking about inner peace and perspective. And he says to the boy, "Have you ever seen a telescope?" And the boy said, "Yeah, I have. I was really amazed. You know, you look through it and things far away look close and little things look big." And the old man says, "When I was about your age," and the boy's 13, he said, "someone gave me a telescope and I looked through it and I was amazed just like you were. And then I turned it around. I looked through the small end and it made big things look small. It made close things look far away. It shrunk everything." And the boy said, "Well, I've never done that." And the old man said, "This is a good metaphor for life and what wisdom is all about. Sometimes when you're in a situation that seems threatening, it seems bad, it seems terrible, maybe you're doing what everybody does and you're looking through the small end of the telescope and you're actually magnifying the situation beyond what it is. Maybe what you need to do is turn that telescope around and look through the other end and shrink things down to manageable size, giving yourself a perspective of wisdom." And so in everything I write, I try to show people how sometimes wisdom is about perspective. Sometimes it's about using insights from the great thinkers to have success in what you're doing. In a book called True Success, I wrote about 7 universal conditions for success, which are bits of wisdom about human nature and how we can position ourselves for success in everything we do. So I think there are things we can do every day to embody wisdom in our lives.
You're listening to Coastline, talking with author and philosopher Tom Morris. We have Vaughn from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on. My question is about, from your perspective as a religious philosopher, what is the role of Buddhism in the world today?
Good question.
Thank you so much for that question, Vaughn.
You know, when Rachel and I started talking today, we started talking about the Greeks and the Romans because my training was first and foremost in Western philosophy, and those are the roots of all Western philosophy. But I got interested in what other traditions had to say about these questions concerning our lives. So I read Buddhism, I read Hinduism, I read Taoism, Confucianism. And in fact, I've got a little ebook that draws on Confucius for 7 chapters, the Tao Te Ching for 7 chapters. Buddhism is about many things, but the core of Buddhism that's been appropriated in the West is about how to keep calm and peaceful in challenging circumstances. In this regard, Buddhists and Stoics think alike, that there's a certain kind of inner resilience that we need in order for any outer results we want to attain. Buddhists have this great concept of releasing. In the West, we talk about setting goals and striving for those goals. Well, the Buddhists have this paradoxical insight that's just as important. No matter how hard you're working toward a goal, no matter how much you want it, there's a certain level at which emotionally you have to release the results. You have to be okay with whatever the next thing is you might face, or else you're going to get all balled up in negativity when the world doesn't seem to give you your goals right away. The Buddhists have these amazing insights about how to position yourself emotionally to allow things to happen as well as to make things happen.
So we talk about being peaceful and having this oasis within, developing that. And you talk about the practice of ethics as leading to personal fulfillment and even business success. Business success, in fact, you say, must be built on an ethical foundation for it to last. But you also quote, if Aristotle ran General Motors, this woman, Florida Scott Maxwell, she wrote The Measure of My Days, and she asks, suddenly I wonder, is all hardness justified because we are so slow in realizing that life was meant to be heroic? Greatness is required of us. That is life's aim and justification. And we poor fools have for centuries been trying to make it convenient, manageable, pliant to our will. How do you reconcile those ideas, the idea of peace inside, the oasis within, personal fulfillment, happiness even, and accepting the hardness that life brings?
It's an amazing thing. Florida Scott Maxwell, she wrote this little book, The Measure of My Days, when she was in her mid to late 80s. And she's reflecting on her life at how much inner fire and exuberance she has in her 80s that she didn't expect. And she also has this perspective. She looks back on her life and she says, you know what? All the hard stuff, all the difficult stuff, all the stuff that was just terrible to go through has ironically and paradoxically created in me the qualities that I've most come to admire. So we're always trying to avoid suffering. I was with a group of investment officers about 2 weeks ago on a retreat in the northern woods of Michigan. And these are some of the most successful investment people in the world. And I asked them a question. I said, what is the number one cause of personal growth? And half the people there answered difficulty, hardship, challenge. And I said, isn't it ironic that that's the thing we try to eliminate from our lives? Because it is the number one cause of personal growth. I mean, I think that if we have the right perspective on our struggles, they're not as bad as they would otherwise have been. And we realize what's going to come from these things.
And we're about to go to break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. 910-343-1138 is the number to call if you have a question for author and philosopher Tom Morris. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and today we're talking with author and philosopher Tom Morris about how the wisdom from the ancient philosophers is as relevant and practical as ever. You have a few minutes left to ask your question today. The number to call is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And in just a moment, we're going to talk to Darlene from Wilmington. But right before we went to break, Tom, you were talking about how trials and tribulations and human suffering is actually what does the most to build character in us. And in your if Aristotle ran General Motors, you quote a Hindu proverb that says, there's nothing noble in being superior to another man. The true nobility is in being superior to your previous self. And you use that as an illustration of your definition of excellence. And we've talked a lot today about sort of the world out there, the presidential campaign, the crises, you know, the refugee crisis, the rise of ISIS, and the fact, you know, are we devolving? But doesn't this always come back to what are you doing inside yourself?
That's right. That's right. There's and the great philosophers have always pointed this out to us. There are two things we could spend our time thinking about and concentrating on. There's the inner soul, and there are our outer circumstances. If you prioritize your own soul, you'll be able to deal with any circumstances. But if you prioritize your circumstances and neglect your soul, you're going to have trouble. And we see both these things playing out, right? There's some people who just seem to flourish no matter what happens. In The Oasis Within, the old man, who's kind of my Dumbledore, my Gandalf, he says to his nephew, he says, you know, I think everybody has a little fire in their soul, but too many people are dumping negative things on that fire all the time. They worry, they're irritated, they're angry, they're frustrated, they have anxiety, and it's almost like they're dampening their soul. But other people.
So negativity dampens the soul.
Negativity dampens the soul. And some people are almost putting out that little pilot light in their hearts. But he said that people who allow the flame to grow, in other words, they cultivate their inner self, then no matter how much debris gets dumped on them in life, they use the debris as fuel for a greater flame. The very things that we've all seen this, right? A small fire, you dump a bunch of wood on it, it puts out the fire. But a big fire, you dump the same amount of scrap lumber on it, and it bursts into an even bigger fire. So Ali, the old man in the oasis, is saying, if you can stoke the fires of your own heart with wisdom, you can deal with any circumstances, and they will grow you and make you better.
It's like Pete in the swamp.
Yeah.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with author and philosopher Tom Morris. If you have a question, give us a call, 910-343-1138. And you can reach us by email at coastline@whqr.org. Darlene from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Darlene.
Thanks for taking my call. I heard you speak years ago, it seems, and I was very impressed and bought several of your books read them. I haven't read anything recently, but now I'm inspired to read The Oasis Within.
Great.
And buy a copy for my college age and college graduate sons.
Awesome.
But my question is more specifically, how can we bring more of this discussion to youth, middle school, even younger,
right,
in years past, maybe
mm-hmm.
Young people were educated in the classic philosophers, and
right.
I think that's, well, I know that is lacking from any kind of education that we offer now. But how could we, as parents, what would you advise as far as reading material, discussion boards, anything?
That's a great question, Darlene. This is something that always bothered me, too, because I was talking to people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. But how do you start people younger? Whenever I've gone to a junior high or high school, which I occasionally have a chance to do, and I give a talk about success in life or something, the kids get so excited. One mother came up to me in the grocery store and said, you spoke to my daughter's school 6 months ago, and I want you to know that for the first time in her life, she's actually setting goals. And I said, oh, that's awesome to hear. One of the reasons I'm glad that I've written these new novels, and so far they're going to be at least eight novels. Eight are written, and they're starting to come out one by one. The Oasis Within, and the first is the prologue to the big series, almost like The Hobbit was to The Lord of the Rings. And the series itself, the first volume, is now out, called The Golden Palace, featuring a 13-year-old boy, a 12-year-old friend, and a bunch of other friends their age, as well as older people. Having read the Harry Potter stories so many times and realizing what got kids so excited about the ideas in those stories, and people don't know, J.K. Rowling was a classics major and knew the Greek and Roman philosophers well, so built in a lot of those ideas into the Potter stories. When these stories started coming to me, I thought, maybe this is my contribution to get younger people talking. And now one school in town is already requiring The Oasis Within for all their ninth graders, which makes me feel really good.
Thank you so much for your call, Darlene. We also have Lisa from Curry. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick comment. I'm really enjoying the show and agreeing with so much of what is being said, and I just thought it was interesting that your perspective on life seems to line up with many of the Christian values that were taught in the Bible, and I just, you know, everything you were saying, I can draw a line to that, and I
absolutely
just wanted to make that comment and see see what you felt about that.
Absolutely, Lisa. Thank you so much for noticing that. I mean, it's funny. I wrote my first book on success in 1994. It's a book called True Success, A New Philosophy of Excellence. And I was touring the country, giving talks to, like one talk was for the 750 top people in Merrill Lynch. I'd be talking for the leadership of International Paper. I'd be talking to the Toyota, Ford Motor Company, Mercedes-Benz. And almost always, somebody would come up to me after the talk and say, you know, a lot of these principles come from the Bible. And I would say, absolutely. In fact, the book of Proverbs alone, you can probably get all seven universal conditions for success that structure my book, True Success. And so as a Christian philosopher, I love it when people see that. But of course, when I'm speaking to a group that involves, you know, Christians and Buddhists and Hindus and atheists and agnostics and all kinds of people, I try to bring it in kind of universal language that they will be invited to get closer and closer to my perspective as a Christian philosopher, but I won't say anything where they'll react by, oh, no, I don't believe that. But it's very gradually introducing them to my take on the truth. And you're absolutely right. These are principles, I think, built into our nature and given to us because we're created not to fail. We're created to succeed. Thank you so much for asking that.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. And it's interesting because when you talk about ethics, you make the point that this is not a restrictive idea.
Right.
In fact, it's an expansive idea.
Yep. Yep.
And it's a guide, and it's a guide to creativity and expansion. And you didn't hear this because you were sitting in the studio with headphones on. But at the very top of the hour, our listeners heard the beginning of the show, which asked, when you approach a business deal, do you think you should A, do unto others as they do unto you.
Uh-huh.
B, do unto others before they do unto you.
Mm-hmm.
C, do unto others as they would be done unto.
Yeah.
Or D. So answer that question for us. And where does this come from?
Yeah, I was on a panel discussion once at Notre Dame with a lot of prominent business people. The guy who solved the Tylenol scandal, for example, one of the biggest builders in America, construction guys, his name was Leo Lindbeck, and he was talking about the golden rule. And a young man stood up in the back of the room and said, Mr. Lindbeck, I've always admired your career as a builder. But if I go into a negotiation and I'm using the golden rule, treating others the way I would want to be treated, and they're not, aren't they going to take advantage of me? Aren't I kind of doing the negotiation with one hand tied behind my back? Isn't it going to go badly for me when I'm trying to be good? And Leo Lindbeck said, well, if the first time, let's say you're negotiating with a guy, if the first time you ever meet him is in that negotiation room, then you're kind of an idiot, he said. If you're going to negotiate a deal with somebody, get to know them 6 months in advance, 6 weeks in advance, a year in advance, days in advance. Treat him in accordance with the golden rule in every interaction. There's this mimicking thing that goes on at a subconscious level. The more you treat people well, the more likely they will be to treat you well. Then when you get into the negotiation room and you use the golden rule, he most likely will too. But if he doesn't, walk away from the deal. Leo Lindbeck said, you cannot make a good deal with a bad person.
Author and philosopher Tom Morris is with us today, former philosophy professor at Notre Dame and the author of more than 20 books. He's answering your questions, and we have Jeremy from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline, Jeremy. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on the show. I'm a great big fan.
Thank you. Glad to have you.
My question was a little bit of background. I'm the eldest of seven kids, and every workplace I go to, every job that I have, I'm always the guy that people come to for advice and always the shoulder to lean on, even if I don't offer it. It's always that way. But my question is, I have been a bartender for 11 years now, and I'm venturing into other jobs as well. But I have had a very difficult time in finding happiness for myself at these jobs. It seems like just crisis management in every job that I do. So do you have any advice on me personally finding my happiness in the jobs that I delve into?
That's a great question, Jeremy. Thank you so much. You talk about self-centeredness being self-defeating and self-giving being self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
But is it possible to become just a servant to everyone else's
needs. You drain the well, right? And there's nothing left at the bottom of the well. That's a problem that's really common, right? For professors, for ministers, for rabbis who are always giving advice to other people. And it's an interesting thing. I've learned in most advice situations to start to listen more than I talk, because sometimes the only thing people really want is to articulate their problem. They learn something from hearing themselves talk about it. They may talk about it in a new way just because you're willing to listen. So the burden is not really always on you to provide great answers to everybody's problems. But if you become a great listener, sometimes that's all they need. And a side benefit is that happiness always comes out of those times in our lives when we're learning. You're learning about a new person, you're learning a new skill, you're learning a new sport, and you really love it because there's something about learning and love and happiness that are always connected. When I wrote the book, If Aristotle Ran General Motors, it wasn't so much about General Motors or even Aristotle. It was about happiness. It was about four foundations for happiness: truth, beauty, goodness, and unity. Living in the truth, living with beauty, living with goodness in our relationships to others, and living with a sense of belonging. And if we start analyzing our lives, are we respecting and nurturing these four things? Or how could we do better? It starts to lift you up. At one point in The Oasis Within, the old man, the wise old man, says to his nephew, look, there's going to come a time in your life where you're really facing something bad. You really need help. You're at rock bottom. And he said, when that happens, if you will find somebody else to help, that will end up lifting you up. And, you know, you can't exhaust yourself in helping everybody with their problems. And listen, I know what it's like. You know, as a bartender, you can hear everybody's problems. But if you're also serving your own soul, you know, giving your own soul those cold drinks they need, right? The truth, beauty, goodness, and unity. You start using those daily to analyze what you're doing. You start finding yourself feeling better about what you're doing and feeling better about all the stuff in your life. It actually works. And I've gotten this testimony from so many people. I mean, thank you so much for asking that question.
Thank you so much for that call, Jeremy. So then talking about goal setting and looking at one's life and saying, well, this is where I am, but this is where I want to be.
Yeah.
In The Oasis Within, Waleed, this young boy, is told that he's going to be a king, and he gets overwhelmed with the responsibility of that. How does one engage in creative striving with love and stay focused on the goal without, because, you know, you have said yourself some of the greatest things that have happened in your life, your career change into a public philosopher, none of these things were goals that you set, nor were they things that you personally could have engineered. They happened.
I know. It's amazing. If I had to come up with a goal, hey, I want to be a public philosopher and give talks in all the major convention centers of America. I want to have classes not of 30 students at Notre Dame, but of 10,000 real estate people in a classroom. I mean, I would never even thought of that. It would never have occurred to me. Most of the big things in our lives, we can't really plan for. But what we can do is, once we see the opportunities developing, sometimes setting goals in small ways to capture those opportunities, to take advantage of those opportunities in a positively opportunistic way, we begin to grow, we begin to expand our vision about something new that we could be doing that we would have had no idea before. Big things can result from small steps.
Okay, we have just a minute or so left. If you could leave our listeners with one idea that would make a qualitative change in their lives, one idea they can practice every day, what would that be?
Life is supposed to be a series of adventures. The adventure you're on right now is setting you up for the next one, sometimes in ways you can't even imagine. The people who live the happiest lives are the people who live their lives as a series of adventures. Have a great one.
That's this edition of Coastline. Tom Morris, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was fun.
His latest book, The Oasis Within, is available on Amazon.com. Coastline airs Wednesdays through the month of August. In September, we'll fire up the Thursday Coastline once again in time for political coverage. Coastline's executive producer and today's phone screener is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it on our website at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.